Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. You're listening to a story from the Essential Sosonko, collected portraits and tales of a bygone chess era by Grandmaster Genna Sosonko. Since the 1980s, Sosonko has written extensively for New in Chess magazine. His chess writings, rather than being technical, chronicle the lives of the former and current top players with whom he has crossed paths. In today's episode, Sosonko takes us along the path of his own personal history against the background of the geopolitical situation in Europe and Russia in the second half of the 20th century and provides insight into why he took up the pen to write his chronicles. Enjoy the stories in today's reading, narrated by professional voice actor Nick Murphy from The Essential Sosonko, Chapter 1, A Vanished Age.
A Vanished Age. On August 18, 2001, my life will be divided into two equal halves. The first took place in St. Petersburg, which was then called Leningrad, and the second in Amsterdam. Although these cities have much in common, for me, St. Petersburg and Amsterdam do not overlap. The Neva and the Amstel are different rivers. And if I happen to be walking along Amsterdam's Tsar Peterstraat or along the Nevsky Prospect past the Dutch Church in St. Petersburg, my peripheral vision registers the difference, and I see very well what sets the two cities apart. Just as a child brought up in a dual-language family knows with whom in which language to speak. The number 5 tram has not changed its route, and it stops close to my house in Amsterdam, just as it did in my past life in Leningrad, but here too no confusion arises. The number of my house in Baskov Lane was 33. For the first 10 years in Amsterdam, I lived in a house number 22, and in the next 10, in a number 11. A few years ago, trying to escape from fate, I moved to a house with a number that had no significance, 16. Foreigners travelling to the Soviet Union usually found the most attractive part of Leningrad to be old St. Petersburg. Now, Leningrad has again become St. Petersburg, remaining Leningrad for perhaps only its elderly inhabitants, who have been accustomed to that name. In chess, the Leningrad variation of the Dutch defence interweaves in amazing fashion the two places where I have lived. Although the sounds from the gusts of wind and the pattering of rain on the Neva or the Amstel are hardly any different, for me, the move from Leningrad to the city where I now live was more than a geographical displacement in space. This move signified the start of a new life. My connections with Holland date back as far as my early childhood. Looking back into the past of half a century ago, I can picture my mother on a December evening in 1948, warming her hands by the Dutch stove. Alongside the Dutch stove was the ottoman on which I slept. There were 4 of us living together. There was also my grandma and my sister in a 25 square meter room of a communal flat. But to me, this room did not seem at all small. Living in this flat, apart from ourselves, were the Cantors, the Galperins, and the Levin Cohens. The only Russian was a young woman, Lyuda, but even she had the surname Serenok. In the first few months in Holland, when I talked about my old home, I was frequently asked, "But how many bedrooms did you have?" I quickly realised that the correct answer would in no way fit in with the concepts of my listeners, and I used to apply in accordance with my mood, sometimes 2, sometimes 3. I can remember myself as a boy in the food store on the corner, standing in a queue for the cash desk in order to punch a receipt for buying some Dutch cheese. I can also picture myself in an advisory role, in a shop on the Nevsky, next to the Kudoshesveni cinema, where my mother spent a long time trying on a hat, which for some reason was called a Dutch hat. Smart with artificial flowers, it was returned to the shop a few hours later, and I was reprimanded. "How on earth could you advise me to buy that one? I am no longer a little girl." In my days as a student, I went for 5 years to the university's geography faculty, opposite a small triangular island called New Holland, with its splendid arch of austere grey beauty. One of Peter the Great's residences was on the island, and the Tsar usually stayed there when he was visiting the Galerny shipyard, where a large number of Dutch craftsmen were at work. He had Amsterdam in mind when he founded his city nearly 300 years ago. Peter the Great took numerous words with him from Holland into the Russian language, mainly associated with the sea, leaving the Dutch only two Russian words. The Dutch Dwerak is by no means as good-natured as the Russian folktale character Durachok, whereas the cheerful verb Pierwijn signifies in Dutch to go on a spree, rather than the Russian Pirovait, which stands for to celebrate with feasting. The lengthy banquets of the young Russian Tsar and the numerous attendants from his embassy, which was in Amsterdam for several months, made a strong impression on the Dutch. In August 1972, the match between Fischer and Spassky, one of the most intriguing world championship matches in the history of the game, was in full swing, but I had no time to think about chess. I was leaving the Soviet Union. Holland represented the interests of Israel, which at that time did not have diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, and I obtained my exit visa in the Dutch embassy in Moscow. It was very close to the Central Chess Club, the way to which was familiar to me from the times of junior tournaments. On ending up outside the boundaries of the Soviet Union, I had the sense of being in the position of a newborn child. My customary situation had disappeared, and a large, unknown world lay before me. I was 29 years old. When I left, I thought that in order to begin a new life, I would have to forget completely about the old one. This proved impossible. The prerogative of disregarding the past belonged only to the Russian Tsar, and Perseus knew long ago that, if after lengthy efforts a dog finally breaks free from its tether and runs away, there will still be a large section of chain hanging round its neck. My present became what it was, largely thanks to my past, which I had wanted to reject. In fact, it was deposited in my memory and in the end crystallised out, but it also happened the other way round. The past would not have been aroused from my memory without this Western period of my life. Moreover, had it not been for this second Dutch half of my life, Russia would not have been opened for me. In order to become aware of Russia, I had to move away from it and see it from a distance. In order to look at it differently, new eyes were needed, because the old ones could see only that which they had been trained to see. Although the Dutch half of my life differs sharply from the first half spent in Russia, it rests on the old half, like an elephant on a tortoise in the Indian parable. They cannot be separated, just as it is impossible to hear the clapping of only one hand. I was taught to play chess by my mother. In the centre of the room, directly opposite the Dutch stove, stood the dining table, covered by a faded oilcloth. Sometimes in the evening, after supper, an old cardboard board would appear on it, and we would play draughts or chess. The board was torn in several places, particularly on the G2 square. Psychoanalysts will easily link this fact with my predilection for the fianchetto of my king's bishop throughout my professional career. We didn't have any chess pieces. We played with bits of paper, on which my mother had written the names of the pieces. Once, we were caught at this by my mother's brother, Uncle Volodya, and he bought us a chess set. The head of one of the white knights soon became unstuck from its base, and when we were playing, it was simply laid flat on the board. My mother's other brother, Adolf, died early in 1941. With such a name, things would not have been easy for him during the war. My mother had been taught to play chess by her father, my granddad, whom I never saw. A year before I was born, during the Leningrad siege, Grandad Reuven died of starvation in January 1942. It was a very cold winter, and in the building it was not much warmer than on the street. In the room where I was to live the first half of my life, Grandad Reuven lay for more than a week until my grandma, who herself could move only with difficulty, managed to take him on a sledge to the cemetery. Here he was buried in a common grave, together with thousands of other victims of the siege. My grandma Tamara, swaying in front of some lighted candles, was saying something in a strange language. "Grandma," I asked her, "Grandma, are you praying to God? Why then don't you go to church?" "When you grow up, you will understand," she replied simply. When I was a little older, my grandma would sometimes talk to me in Yiddish. She died when I was 6 years old. My German is my Dutch, diluted with the Yiddish of Grandma Tamara, with an occasional sprinkling of German words. In the meantime, my father had another family, and when I was asked about him, I used to say, "My father does not live with us. We had no contact." When filling in a form, or the special column in the class register, where information about your parents was required, I always felt uncomfortable and envied the boys who proudly wrote about their father, "He fell at the front." I only saw my father a handful of times. The last one was in a crowded trolley bus on the Nevsky, when, after giving an affirmative reply to the question as to whether I was getting off at the next stop, I turned round and saw him. My father did not recognise me. He was very short-sighted. The following year, he died. My mother always began a game of chess by advancing both of her central pawns 2 squares. I, naturally, followed her example. It is probably this that explains my liking for space and for central play, which I still retain to this day. When playing football in Tavrishevsky Park in the summer of 1954, I broke my arm, sentenced to the wearing of a plaster for a month, I played chess. This fascination went a long way, and I am experiencing the complicated consequences of it to this day. Now, almost half a century later, when I am no longer playing chess, or playing only rarely, it sometimes happens that my arm hurts in that place where it was broken. The doctor says that this is the fruit of my imagination, and that it is impossible. After finishing school, I entered the geography faculty of the university. The studies there were not very onerous, and there were plenty of time left for chess. I specialised in the economic geography of the capitalist countries. As a chess encyclopedia, published in England, remarks, thereby fitting himself for his future career in the West. Although I was a master in the Soviet Union, I played little, spending more time on training work. At one time, I used to help Tal, and in the last year before my departure, Korchnoi. My decision to leave the country was not liked by the authorities. On a stand in the foyer of the Shigorin Club, for a long time after I had left, 2 notices were pinned up. On one of them, under a list of the Leningrad teams, one could read, "Trainer, Master G. Sosonko," while the other was a decree of the sports committee regarding my disqualification as a result of my betrayal of the motherland. They happily existed side by side until someone decided to remove the first one. My genuine professional chess career began in the West. For the sake of brevity, I shortened my name, and for solidarity, I added an N to it. I was briefly tempted to keep my full name after a Dutch journalist divided it into 2 parts, imparting to it an aristocratic Italian sound, Genna di Sosonko. Even more curious was its writing in the Chinese manner, So Son Ko, on the programme of a simultaneous display which I gave somewhere in Belgium in the spring of 1974. The Genna who lived in Russia and the Genna who appeared in the West bear the same surname, but in many respects they are very different people, not to say totally different. The inscription recently made on the book of a friend from the first period of my life, to Genna, whom I still remember as Genna, I did not take at all as a joke. It's more than years and versts that separate me from Russia. 2 months after I settled down in Holland, I began working for Shark Bulletin. This magazine was the predecessor of New in Chess, in which most of the stories comprising this book were first published. I combined working for the magazine with playing in tournaments. As my successes grew, playing became more important. In the spring of 1973, I had a conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Z. He offered me a job teaching Russian in Harderwijk. These were intensive army courses that taught the young men the language of the most probable enemy. The Lieutenant Colonel himself spoke excellent Russian. Much to his surprise, I declined, explaining that my hobby had become my profession. In contrast to the shaky existence of a chess professional, he was offering something highly respectable, but even so, it restricted something for the sake of which I had left the Soviet Union. When we said goodbye, he gave me his visiting card, just in case you change your mind. Sorting out some old papers recently, I came across it, and could not decide immediately to which period of my life it related. It is unlikely to be of any use now. I don't know how my life would have turned out had I accepted his offer. One thing is obvious, I would not have seen the world to the extent that I have seen it, thanks to my profession. Playing chess at a professional level demands extreme concentration, intensity, and a complete absorption in another, artificial world. I always found it difficult switching from my normal state to the world of tournament chess, and those who knew me in these two states will tell you that they know two different people. Chess has given me a great deal. This world of play is like life in miniature. In chess too, you cannot take a move back, and time for a game is also restricted. Looking at chess, one can say that its present is uncertain, its future uneasy, and only the past remains brilliant forever. Although I know that it was no great mind who came up with the thought that in olden times the sky was more blue, the girls were prettier, queen sacrifices were more spectacular, and finally, that the people in chess were more interesting, I cannot dismiss the thought. It's true. It's true. Golden Schachzeiten was the title given by Milan Widmar to his book about chess in the first half of the 20th century. But was not the whole of the last century a golden one? Would not the great players of the past, looking at the chess of the start of the new century, have experienced something akin to the feelings of Lorenz? The creator of the classical theory of atoms regretted that he had lived through to the triumph of quantum mechanics and had seen how everything in his science, including his own contributions, had become uncertain. From a world of romanticism, dreams, and uncertainty, chess has been transformed into the severe truth of life. Just as a ballerina, having danced the part of Cinderella and who, after the performance, ends up on an operating table due to severe appendicitis, is transformed into the world of reality. The chess of the past, with its halo of mysteriousness, may seem naive and full of mistakes. But in the second half of the 21st century, will not the chess of the first half seem the same? We are approaching the revealing of the last secret of the game. Given correct play, is the advantage of the first move sufficient for a win, as Philidor asserted, or if the game is conducted ideally, does a draw nevertheless result? But who can give a guarantee that this last truth in chess will prove interesting? Fortunately, chess has strong arguments in its defence. W.H. Auden wrote that poetry is a completely non-essential thing, and it justifies the fact that it exists only by the fact that it is completely not essential to know it. These words equally apply to chess. This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl. Since 1974, I played for the Dutch team against the Soviet Union in Olympiads and European Championships. It need hardly be said that these games were quite different for me than those in matches for Holland against, say, Mexico or Iceland. At the Olympiad in Buenos Aires in 1978, the Soviet Union met Holland in the last round, and whether or not the USSR won the Olympiad depended on the outcome of this match. The night before the last round, the leaders of the Soviet team tried to persuade me not to play in that match. The conversation took place on various levels, from "the possibilities of obtaining entry visas to our country are not unlimited" to "don't forget that you still have a sister in Leningrad." They did not manage to convince me. "I am playing for Holland, not against the Soviet Union," I repeated, which was not entirely true. A short line from a Soviet newspaper: "In the USSR-Holland match, Pologievsky's game on board too ended in a draw," was my reward. After my departure, my name could not appear in the Soviet press. A report in the Leningrad sports paper about how first to third places in the 1973 Dutch championship were shared by Enklar and Zuidema is something that I retain to this day. The tournament in Waddinxveen in 1979 was opened by the Dutch Prime Minister Van Eyck. Also present was the Soviet Union's ambassador Tolstikov, who in my time had been the party boss in Leningrad. "Do you know the Dutch expression, keep your chin up?" the Prime Minister asked me, wishing me luck in the tournament. "Well, you are a Leningrader, keep your chin up. Show them what we're worth, Leningrader," with deliberate rudeness, repeated the ambassador, a Khrushchev type of man, short and fat. I did not know whom to listen to, and with mixed feelings I began my first game with Karpov. The words, "keep your chin up, Leningrader," pursued me for a long time. Participating in Olympiads, European Championships, or in international tournaments, I regularly met players from the Soviet Union, and not only at the chessboard. I knew most of them from the time when I myself had lived there. Some of them were my friends. Contact with an emigrant could not be approved by the leader of the delegation, who was nearly always present at a foreign tournament in which Soviet players were taking part. Therefore, we usually met a block or two away from the hotel, and for walks, we chose streets that were as distant as possible. On the pages of Soviet newspapers at that time, one could come across the expression "internal emigrant." My friends undoubtedly came under this definition. For some of them, the internal emigration proved too restricting, so they left the Soviet Union and now live in various countries. When going off to interzonals or other official tournaments, Soviet grandmasters were presented with dossiers on the foreign participants in these tournaments. The dossiers were usually compiled by students from the chess department of the Institute of Physical Culture. They gave a detailed analysis of both the positive aspects of a player and his weaknesses. Obtaining them from my friends on a couple of occasions, I read the descriptions of me myself. They were sensibly written, and I read them with great interest, since it is always curious to know what is thought about you by others, especially when they are not known to you at all. Nearly all the emigrants who left Russia after 1917 regarded themselves as part of Russia that had temporarily gone abroad, rather than having left the country for good. When I left the Soviet Union, I knew that I was leaving forever. Those were the rules of the game. The state unwillingly gave permission for emigration, if it gave it at all, and emigration had to be complete and final. Any attempt to visit the country later was doomed to failure. I knew that I would never see either those close to me or my city again. It was with this feeling, forever, that I said goodbye to them forever. At the end of 1974, my mother was not allowed to come and stay with me in Amsterdam. And 6 months later, I did not even make the hopeless attempt to bid a last farewell to her in Leningrad. In the second half of August 1982, the telephone rang in my house, and a businesslike voice informed me that an exhibition chess tournament was to be held on a cruise ship and invited me to take part in it. This did not fit in with my plans. I had little time as I was busy preparing for the tournament in Tilburg, then the strongest in the world. I declined, but before hanging up, I inquired about the route of the ship. "The Baltic Sea," said the manager. "The usual route, Copenhagen, Stockholm, Helsinki." "And then?" I asked. Then Leningrad, he said with indifference. I looked at the calendar. It was August 18, the 10th anniversary of my departure. I said that I would think about it. My friends and acquaintances advised me not to go on the trip, and an official from the Foreign Ministry in The Hague, whom I phoned for consultation, quite reasonably remarked, "Of course, you have a Dutch passport, but these are uncertain times and anything can happen. You must know that." I said to myself that they were right. My heart missed a beat when, on the morning of September 12, a young frontier guard by the gangplank of the Lady Astor threw my Dutch passport into a deep box after giving me, along with the other passengers who were setting off on an excursion to the Hermitage, a red-coloured document. On opening it, one could read the rules of behaviour for passengers of the cruise ship. One of the first points described precisely that for the sake of which I had made the trip. It was forbidden to undertake any individual actions not connected with the excursion programme. The Intoris bus was held up on the Dvortsovi Bridge, bogged down by a mass of runners clad in tracksuits. Later I learned that Runners' Day was one of the largest new mass sport festivals in the Soviet Union. It was a wonderful September day. The Neva was sparkling in the sunshine, and looking around, I could see on the left the buildings of the university and the Cabinet of Curiosities, and on the right the rostral columns and the Peter and Paul Fortress. The guide in the bus did not waste time. Directly in front of you is the Hermitage. The museum houses one of the greatest collections of pictures in the world. The Hermitage was founded. In front of the Hermitage, my sister, who had been notified beforehand, was due to be waiting for me. My eyes, which for a decade had become estranged from contours familiar from childhood, easily absorbed them. It was the sounds of voices that were surprising. The bus windows were open, and all the people on the run were talking in the language of my youth. Within a quarter of an hour, the mass of people had abated and the bus started moving. Space is measured in time. It now separates Amsterdam from St. Petersburg by a 3-hour flight. In St. Petersburg, as in Amsterdam, I have routes that I like to follow on my walks. I go along the Nevsky, always keeping to one side, just as I used to do when I was an inhabitant of this city. On reaching the intersection of the Nevsky Prospect with Vostanaya Street, I halt for an instant. At this place, I stood with my mother and sister in an immobile crowd on a cold March day in 1953. People were standing everywhere, on the pavements, on the carriageways, on the balustrades of the metro station that was being built, and many were crying. The time was 12:05, and suddenly the sirens and horns of the immobile vehicles began to scream. All the men removed their fur hats, and my mother began untying the ear flaps of mine. It was the day of Stalin's funeral. I turned to the left, past several blocks, and then, in the corner, there is the house. I climb up to the first floor. The steps of the staircase are so worn that it is hard to believe that they are made of stone. Our flat no longer exists. It is now used for bookkeeping courses. They were also held in my time in the door opposite, and on the landing, during breaks between classes, aspiring bookkeepers were always smoking. The kitchen of our communal flat is now a classroom. In place of the large flagstone, on which stood the oil stoves and primuses, and where our neighbour, Tsilia Nomovna, was usually stewing udders, bought at the Maltsevsky market, there are now several computers. The room where I lived is the director's office, and on the door is a sign showing the hours of admission. Of those who once lived in this room, I am the only one still alive. I am completely calm when I think about them. And not because I know that we are all mortal. I know that living in the graveyard, one cannot weep for everyone, even for those to whom you are part of life, and to some, even life itself. Memories crowd into my mind one after another, like the enormous stones of the Wailing Wall. If anything, I am pleased when there suddenly arises another one, which appeared to have been buried forever, a meeting of the inhabitants of the flat, and passionate debates about the need to castrate Barsik, the communal cat, who does not suspect anything and is playing here in the kitchen, or the expression of Polina Solovna, a very old woman with feeling reciting to me, a six-year-old, the fable, The Dragonfly and the Ant. Two brilliant Russian writers of the 20th century lived in this city. Both of them left Russia. One went in April 1919 by boat from Sevastopol. The other, in May 1972, took the Aeroflot flight to Vienna, the usual route to freedom at that time. 3 months later, I was to take the same route. Neither Vladimir Nabokov nor Joseph Brodsky ever returned to St. Petersburg. Nabokov did not heed the advice of his friend, Prince Kuchurin, to travel there incognito. Instead of himself, he sent his alter ego in one of his verses. Brodsky has not really been back either, although he was invited. Having once seen the real Venice, he preferred it forever to the northern one. Like Nabokov, Brodsky too returned several times to his city in his poems and essays, although he also recognised that in terms of hopelessness, all attempts to revive the past are similar to endeavours to comprehend the meaning of life. Looking at the past, I realise that it has changed. I am aware that the past ages with every day, drowns in the present and is revived with difficulty. In reality, we are writing about what this past has become in the present. It is far easier to write about the past than be in it. The unrealized, the lost, that which could have been carried out and will never be carried out, makes any past painfully sad. In order to accept the past, one requires the courage of reconciliation, the ability to see everything in the way that this past actually was, without embellishment, wrappings, or illusions. I know that memory is optimistic. Certain scenes appear to me now, decades later, to be more idyllic than they were in actual fact, or, at any rate, less coloured by the emotions of the moment. Memory is able not only to wash away the dark tones of the pain of the past, but it also possesses the ability to brighten up sorrowful memories, bypassing the palaces and galleries of memory, as St. Augustine put it. I sometimes stumble across something amusing or insignificant. My memory constantly deviates from the main paths, but sometimes some trifling act, joke, or word flung by chance says no less than authorised documents. At the age of 88, Bertrand Russell remembered Gladstone, whom he had seen in 1889, when the latter was an old man. After dinner, they, the only men, remained at the table. Russell, who was then 17, expected to hear something divine. "This is a very good port. I wonder why they have given it me in a Bordeaux glass," said Gladstone. "And this port, poured into a Bordeaux glass, is closer for me than all the sayings of the great Englishman." "For correspondence," a boy replied to me at a tournament in Indonesia in 1982, and I remember his crafty smile to this day. I had just given him my autograph, and he had asked me to write my address alongside it. I see Misha Tal lighting another cigarette, and with a nervous movement crossing out a move already written on his score sheet. I see the bushy eyebrows of Lev Pologievsky and his sorrowful look before he lands the decisive blow in one of our games. Of the game itself, only the vague contours remain in my memory, and recently, in order to restore it, I had to resort to the help of my computer database. I am one of those people who are strong on hindsight, and too often in life, and also in chess, I have relied on the Russian Avos. It will return, and somehow it will turn out right. Now I feel annoyed about the fact that many conversations with the protagonists of this book have remained forgotten. I also regret that the questions, answers to which could now have been of interest to the reader, were simply never asked. At the time, these questions did not occur to me. The everyday trifles seemed more important. The rare jottings of those times are an indifferent aid to the memory. An old photograph can only scare away recollections. It is a well-known paradox. The more you look at familiar features on photographs from the distant past, the paler the image itself becomes. Those about whom I have written are no longer with us, but it depends on how you look at it. I see their faces, their gestures, and their manner of speaking. I hear their voices. Referring to them signifies going backwards on the River Lethe, to there where there is no future and where there is only the past, to there where everything, once and for all, is put in its place, to the young Lev Polagievsky on the beach in Sukhumi, to Misha Tal trying to elicit from the laughing maestro about how exactly the civil war in Spain began, to Semyon Furman, bent low over his transistor radio, to Olga Capablanca, examining a medallion depicting the last Russian Tsar in the window of an antique shop on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. I knew that time does the same thing to people that space does to monuments. If you stand too close or too far away, you risk not seeing anything. Both the one and the other can be appreciated at a distance, from a specifically chosen point. I have endeavoured to find that point. While appreciating the great difficulty of the task, I should have liked to at least approach that depiction of them, where the last truth is lit up by the funeral carriage, knowing that a textbook, polished image of these people would be unworthy of them and far from reality. All of those described in this book were linked, in some way or another, with the country in which I lived the first half of my life, the Soviet Union. Just as it is not possible, without damaging the pediment of a 19th century building, to remove the emblem with the hammer and sickle painted on it in Soviet times, so it is impossible to imagine those who are described in this book outside of that time where the red colour of the state that no longer exists dominated the world map. Chess, in the Soviet Union, under the unremitting attention and control of the authorities, was closely amalgamated with politics, like everything in that amazing country. The closed nature of society and its isolation from the free world were reasons why talent and energy frequently splashed out in comparatively neutral fields. This closed nature and isolation of society merely assisted the development of chess, creating an entire cultural stratum, the enormous world of Soviet chess. This world consisted of a large army of professional players, official and covert, as well as trainers and organisers. This world has gone forever, with its crowds of fans following the games of world championship matches on enormous demonstration boards installed on a theatre building in the centre of Moscow, because there were no free places in the auditorium. In this world, pensioners bent over chessboards on park benches in 20 degrees of frost, and old women patiently awaited their grandchildren at a theoretical lesson where they were first showed the legal mate. This was a world where matches for the World Chess Championship made the front pages of newspapers, and life itself inspired the libretto of a musical, which for years played to packed houses in the best theatres of London and New York. In this world, participation in the championship final of the country was an achievement in itself, a dream that remained unfilled for many strong masters. This was an era when the public, with their subtle understanding of the game, frequently rewarded with applause a pretty win or a spectacular combination. For several hours at a time, one could exchange opinions about the positions on the stage with a completely unknown person and then part with him forever, or, on the contrary, become a friend for life. In the press centre of such championships, one could meet masters and grandmasters whose names would be an enhancement to any international tournament. For the bulletins, devoted to each round of the championship, one had to queue at newspaper kiosks, and radio reports from the tournaments were broadcast in the sports section of the latest news. The names of the people from that world about whom I have written were on everyone's lips, and in popularity they were not inferior to film stars. It would be a pity if those names were irrevocably lost. The odd details which I have unconsciously stored in the money box of memory have been fused together, creating portraits of people whom I had the good fortune to meet. Gathered together, these portraits have unexpectedly become the sum of my personal experience during the past years. Each time, after one of those whom this book is about passed away, I wanted to read about them. Later, I realized that I wanted to read about them what I myself knew. More than this, what only I knew. Deprived of this possibility, I decided to write about them. Hence, this book.
This was a story from the book The Essential Sosunko. It is available at newinchess.com. A new podcast will be available every Friday on Spotify and Apple. Check out newinchess.com/podcast.